Let's continue reading this parable of two lost sons. Verse 25, now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing, and he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, your brother has come, your father has killed the fattened calf, because he's received him back safe and sound. But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him, but he answered his father, look, these many years I've served you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who's devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him. And he said to him, son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. This is the word of the Lord. You heard me call this the parable of the two lost sons, because that's what it is. Often we hear about it as the parable of the prodigal son. And that's the story of the way it's told in churches, that this is the story of a lost, reckless, no good, quote unquote, prodigal son. And what a story, right? I mean, he goes to the father and he says, look, this is the younger one. I want to act as if you're dead. Give me my share of the inheritance. And he goes off into the far country and he wastes it. We hear there's prostitutes. You know, this is no good living. You know what this stuff is. And then he has this awakening, this younger son of his. And we kind of have a feeling that he's turning good, but really what it is he's broke. He's sleeping with the pigs. He's got nowhere else to turn. He thinks to himself, I'd have a better option being a slave in my father's house than living out here longing for pig slop in the far country. I know what I'd do. I'll go back and beg to be a servant in my father's house. And then in this great gospel moment, as the son comes down the road, the father sees him far, far off, and he runs and embraces him and kisses him and brings him into the house, and there's a celebration, you know. And we tell this story in church, and we tell it secretly because we want to say, look, it doesn't matter how bad you've been, God will welcome you back if you're good, right? That's the kind of scheme that we work off of. Religious awakening is going from being bad to being good. But here's the problem with that picture and that paradigm. There are two sons in this story. If there was only one son, we could do the good, bad thing, that religion was about being good and irreligion was about being bad. But there's two sons in this story. And Jesus, in doing that, is doing something very particular. What he's doing is attacking this good, bad paradigm that the Pharisees and the Jews had of their time. The Jewish system, very much like ours in the back of our mind, was if you're good, God likes you. If you're bad, God doesn't like you. But there is this problem of the older son. Because if you read it as good and bad, if you read the younger son as he went from bad to good, then when you come to the older son, which we're going to talk about this morning, it gets a little bit confusing. Because here's the problem with the older son. He is good. The older son is good, but he's lost. And what Jesus is trying to say is, look, you've got a good older son, and you've got a bad younger son, and the situation with both of them is actually the same. Both of them are lost. And if your religion is operating on this good-bad paradigm, that is, if good is being favored by God and bad is being not favored by God, then this parable is going to be utterly confusing to you. Because Jesus is undoing that entire system of religion. And he's going right at the Pharisees, and he's going right at us. And he's saying, you know, the good-bad paradigm, frankly, in this parable is more the effect than it is the cause. And that what Jesus is going to do is he's going to undo that paradigm, and he's going to replace it with something deeper, the gospel. And that's what we're going to find out, what that actually means this morning. So let's take a minute and talk about the older brother for a second. And I want to prove to you he's good. You probably already know that, right? You might find it a little strange if you go to church here a lot that we would call anybody good, because like we frequently say, we're equal opportunity offenders. Everybody's a sinner when they enter this church. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Why are we saying that one person is religiously good? Because in Jesus' time, there's this thought, you know, that if you're Israel, you're in the covenant with God, and you kept the days, the rituals, the days of atonement, you followed the law, even when you broke them, you could make up for it. And so there was a sense that you could be good. And Jesus is taking this as a given. He's not here debating about whether somebody can be good or bad. He's saying, okay, so you think everybody can be good. Let's just go on that assumption. Let me tell you the parable of an older brother who was bad, who was good, and a younger brother who was bad. And so he starts this parable on with the older son. He says, verse 25, the older son was coming in from the field. This is the first indication the older son is good, because he was doing what he was supposed to be doing. The older son took the money, went in the far country, squandering it, living recklessly. What was the older son doing? He was working dad's fields. He was profiting his father. He was doing what a good son should do. And then a little bit later on, verse 29, he says to his father, look, these many years I have served you. I've never disobeyed your commandment. He thinks he's good, and the father doesn't debate him on that. Do you see the father debate? The father doesn't say, no, you disobeyed this rule and this rule. I mean, the father's, yeah, basically, you've been a great son. You've done everything I've asked you to do. You are, you know, anybody play that role in your family, you know, where you're the good older brother, older sister? You got that no good sibling? You know what this is like. Obviously, you're nudging your sister, your brother, aren't you? That's what's happening. I like it. You should. Obviously, the older brother in this parable is the Pharisees, first and foremost. Pharisees were the people that followed the rules. Sometimes we give them a bad rap, but in the best sense of it, they were trying their best to do everything that their Father in heaven had commanded them to do. And the same goes for us. I mean, the situation translates us. Look, we're a people that have a set of rules, whether you're religious or not, whether it's the first time you've been in church in 2 years or not, you have a system that you set up, a set of rules that you think to yourself, this is what makes me right. You know, you see, your system might be that I've worked hard, I've made wise decisions, I've pulled myself up by the bootstraps, and I'm a success, and other people who haven't done that aren't as good as me. That's not necessarily religious. You know, it might be things as silly and small as, you know, we keep our house really neat and organized. And when I walk in somebody's house who isn't neat and organized, I'm thinking to myself, well, I'm a much better person than they are. Except for what you don't realize is, when that person who's as messy walks into your house, they think the opposite about you. They think, oh, this person spends all their time cleaning up and organizing and wasting their life. I'm a better person than them. You know, that's what it is. We set up these little pods where we think these little sets of rules. And look, in Mobile, I mean, there's a very strong cultural sense of what the system is that makes you good. And it's different than it would be if we were living in New York City or San Francisco or even somewhere like Atlanta, right? In Mobile, I mean, there's a system of family, of religion, and of our community. And none of those things are bad. But they're what we use to justify ourselves. Like family, for instance. You know, I noticed that people, they live in Mobile because it's a great place to raise a family. Right? Isn't that what we all say? We want to live here because, so there's automatically this sort of commitment that we have as a group to say, we love our kids. And so we go to all their soccer games and we save for college, you know, and that makes us right. We're good family people. We're a very religious community, Mobile is. I mean, everybody's a member of a church in Mobile, right? You can't run for office in Mobile unless you're a member of a church. Let me tell you, that's not the case in New York City. We have a sense of community. That is that we have history, we have parties, we have charities, we have things that we do in our community. And when we are well viewed by the people around us, that in some way makes us right. And all of it is sort of, whether it's religious or not, it's a set of criteria that we live by that justifies ourselves. And the older brother has this same system. Saying, I've done everything right. I've listened to my father. And the father's saying, yeah, you're right. You know what, son? You are good. But you're lost. The older son is good, but he's lost. And I think that's where these other parables come into play. You know, these sets of three that this goes in. There's a parable of a lost coin, a lost sheep, and then there's the parable of these two lost sons. It's not the parable of the lost coin, the lost sheep, the lost younger brother, and the older brother who was really good and nobody recognized it. No. Four things are lost. Sheep, coin, younger brother, and the older brother. And what Jesus is saying is, yeah, there's one that's bad, and yeah, there's one that's good, but both of them are essentially lost. And the way that we know that, first and foremost, is, and you might have to take my word for it, we can talk about it afterwards, but we know where it is. The Father's house is what determines being found and alive. If you are in this parable, you are in the Father's house. That's the symbol of being found. Notice how the younger brother got lost. Yeah, he was bad. That was the effect. He was actually lost the moment he said, I want you dead, I want the money, and he heads out of the house into the far country. As soon as he leaves the house, he's lost. Notice where the older brother is in this parable. He's coming out of the field, sure, he's in the covenant with Israel. But he's not in the house. I mean, the parable says he drew near to the house, but he doesn't go in. Verse 28, he says he was angry and he refused to go in. Jesus is saying here, yes, the older brother is good, but he's lost because he's outside of the Father's house. He's in the same position that his younger brother was in. Now, what is it that makes him lost? It's right here in between the lines. He comes up to the house. He's angry. He's mad. His dad has welcomed back this younger brother of him. But the translation here is not so great in our Bibles. The translation says that the father's killed the fattened calf. This is the news he hears in verse 27. Because the son has come back safe and sound. Safe and sound is not really the best translation. I like Kenneth Bailey's. Kenneth says, the father kills the fattened calf because he's welcomed the son back in peace. He's welcomed back in peace. The father's not just, you know, it's not just that the dad's glad that the son came back and he didn't have any injuries and he's back in. No, what the father has done is something far more radical than that. He has declared peace between him and this prodigal, reckless, God-hating son of his. And what that means is, essentially, he's written the son back into the will. And he didn't make the son pay it back. He didn't make the son go out and earn and punish. He just said, son, you're back in it. Now, you're the older brother. You're kind of mad at this point, right? Because your younger brother just spent all the money, and then he got welcomed right back in. He just got a portion of your money. And see, this is an indication that the older son is lost because he's upset about first and foremost is the money. is that welcoming in his younger brother cost him most of his inheritance. By the way, that's the gospel, isn't it? That when we get welcomed in, it costs our older brother his inheritance. Keeps going though. What the son's working on here is he's not on this father-son paradigm. He keeps going. He says, I never disobeyed you. Yet, he says to the father, you never gave me a goat or killed a fattened calf. So the indication here is, you know, dad, what I was in this thing for all the time was the stuff. You know, the deal was I was going to do this and you were going to then give me that. That this isn't father-son we're working on. This is employer-employee. And you see, the older son is just like the younger son. The younger son was a little more explicit. I mean, he said to the dad, I want you dead. I want my money. I want to go do what I want to go do. Let's not have a relationship. Just give me the stuff. The older son's a little more devious about it. The older son saying, look, I'm going to do everything I'm supposed to do. I'm going to earn my wage. And at the end of the day, I'm going to deserve your stuff. It's a contract. The older son doesn't want the father. He wants the father's stuff. And the father picks up on this. You know, you may feel like the older son is righteous and saying, like, why did you do this? No, he's dead wrong. And the father points it out. The father says, why are you so worried about what I'm doing? I mean, why are you complaining about the fattened calf? All that I have is yours. You were always with me. What he's telling the older son is, look, you could have had a fattened calf. You could have had a young goat. You could have had anything that was mine. The older son didn't get it. He didn't get that this was father's son and that he could have anything that the father's, that was the father's. And it's because he looked at it, he thought, this is a contract. This is transactional. That I'm going to work and I'm going to get what I deserve. And he misses the fact that all along, the father was the prize. The older son, the younger son are just two sides of the same coin. Both are lost. One is good, one is bad. Both of them are lost because neither of them want their father. They just want his stuff. They just want to be in a contract with him. And there's a lot of us that play that game with God. I mean, we justify ourselves as good. Tell ourselves we followed all the rules. And therefore, we deserve what we've earned. You know, and you can feel the pinch of that system in the quiet of your thoughts. And you get, and it's when you get a little bit angry, you can begin to kind of needle that. And you can think to yourself, you know, like, I've worked really hard. And I've, you know, I've been honest. I've taken risks. I've put my time in. And yet I'm not as successful as I deserve to be, God. Why is that? You know, I know this from Christians all the time, and we struggled from it. Is, you know, I've gone to church, I've read the Bible, I've done what God said. Why is my marriage so miserable? You know, I thought the deal was I was going to do everything that God wanted, and therefore everything was going to turn out okay, and I was going to be happy. I've done the right thing. I've followed God. I never disobey. And yet I don't have a fattened calf. I'm stuck with a sack of a coal. And deep down, the paradigm was, if I was good, it would all work out the way I wanted it to. And what my anger shows is that all along, I was really pretty lost. And by the way, this doesn't matter, Christian, not Christian. Because Christians do this more than people who are not Christians. Christians do this more where they play this sort of game. God, if I, then you. Older brothers have a deep, hidden, ugly truth in their hearts. They don't want the Father. They want the Father's good stuff. They'll be good. They'll follow the rules. They do what they should do. But then things have to turn out right. And when they don't, they'll be upset. I remember thinking this. In my 20s, we were starting to be grown-ups and we're having babies and jobs and, you know, life's kind of enveloping before us and everything was going fine, but going great, you know. But there was this just like perpetual sense of dissatisfaction that I had with my life. And I would just sort of, it would just sort of trickle out in places, you know. I'd sort of say it here. I'd sort of say it there. I mean, things were fine, but they weren't quite good enough. And I remember I was sort of doing that, playing that sort of game in front of my old boss, and he turned to me and in a moment of really just, I think it was offhanded to him, but he just skewered me. He said, "Yeah, like, you know what your problem is?" He said, "You're in it for a life. You're in it for your life. You're in it to recreate the life that you have. And I just don't know that that's what God has for me." And I was like, I want to punch him right in his face when he said it to me. I'm like, "Who are you? I mean, you're as spoiled and as comfort driven as anybody I know." And that's why he had credibility with me. And he was right. You know, I was just sort of in it for, like, I mean, deep down, here's what the deal is. Like, okay, I mean, I'm a pastor here, right? I mean, I'm going for it. I'm going for the God, I'm doing everything you want kind of thing. I thought in my mind, that's about as it goes. Maybe I'm not going to go overseas and be a missionary. Okay, I was one short of that. Give me some credit here. Better than you. No, I'm just kidding. That's not true. That's not true. That's not the point of the story. Don't go home and say that. Maybe I thought that sometimes. And it is like, I thought, okay, well, I'm doing all the things that God wants me to do. And therefore my life should turn out the way I want it to. And I even thought in my mind, like, I was being pretty reasonable in my requests. You know, that was the religious part of me, was just to tone it down a little bit. You know, it's like, I'm like, okay, I'm not asking to be really wealthy or really famous or to have, I'm just like, I just want like 60% of that. That's religious, right? And he just read my mail. He just stuck it right to me. He said, no. What you're in it for is the stuff. You're not in it for the gospel. See, you know, that whole system, if I, then, that's not the gospel. That may be Islam. It may be the American dream. It may be the proverbial wisdom of your family. You know, you reap what you sow. That is not the gospel of Jesus Christ. The gospel doesn't promise that if you do it all, you know, you do everything right, then it's going to turn out okay. What the gospel promises is God himself. That's it. And that's deep water to tread in. I mean, the gospel is, I love how John Piper says it. Piper says, God is the gospel. That what Christ died for, what he gave up heaven for, what he came to earth for, was not so that everything would turn out in life the way you want. It was so that you would have God himself. God is the gospel. And if you're in it for anything other than him and him alone, you are going to be sorely disappointed and you're going to end up lost. And that was the problem the older brother had. And the father called him on it. And the father said, "Look, you've had me the whole time. And you've had all my stuff." That's not what he wanted. The father wasn't the prize. The father wasn't the goal. Even the father's stuff, if it came with the father himself, he didn't want it. You know, this is why I think suffering and failure are such refining fires. They're such lenses into the deep desires of our heart. Because when you fail and when you suffer, you find out what you really think about God. My anger at things going wrong is a sign that I didn't really want God himself. I just wanted his stuff. And the invitation of the gospel is God in the middle of the mess. You know what the great example of this is? It's Job. Job, this is the whole book of Job, actually. Job is the man who did everything right and had everything. Beautiful wife, great job, revered by his friends. I mean, he was even the spiritual leader. He would pray for his kids. He would offer sacrifice. He did everything right. He had everything. And Satan, the parable in this, in Job, have got to be connected. Satan goes to God. And Satan says, look, you think Job loves you? And God says, absolutely, Job loves me. And he says, Job doesn't love you. Job just loves that you have all, he has all your stuff. And it, and if that stuff was taken away, Job wouldn't appear so godly as he did. God says, fine, go ahead, take, you know, have your way. And so Satan goes down, and within a day, the house that all his children were in collapses. They all die. His fields get burned. Armies come in. He gets these sores all over his body. He has to pick at them with glass. I mean, he is turned into a worm of a man in an instant. You know what Job does? He worships God. His response is to worship God. His response is, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. See, that's a man who's in it for God himself. So what do you do? What do you do if you're the older brother? You're whining, you're complaining, you're out. Well, here's the great part. Here's the gospel of this parable. But you know, just as the father ran to meet the son, embraced, kissed the younger one who he had no business doing, it is the same with the older brother. Here's the older brother, and he is outside pouting and embarrassing his father. He is protesting. You know, it's like he's got a sign and he's outside marching. My dad is an idiot. My dad doesn't know what's going on. That's what he's, and in the middle of this celebration, in this party that the father is giving. And you know what the father does? He goes out. It says that he went out and he entreated the son. That's the gospel. And in the middle of the son's pouting, the father goes out to him. Now look, the fathers in this time, they're not like us namby-pamby 21st century dads. You know, oh honey, do you think you'd like to go to bed now? You know, would you like some vegetables? You know, okay, don't get upset. Okay, Johnny, you know. That's not this dad. That's not what he's doing. He should have punished the son. He was a man of prestige and wealth and honor. He should have sent the son away. He should have made the son come back and grovel. That would have been typical of a father like him. But you know what he does? He goes out to his older son. Even though his older son has proved that he doesn't really understand or love, he goes out to him and he says, son, all that I have is yours. That's what God does for you in Christ. That what he has done is to give up heaven to embarrass himself by stooping low and coming to you with the invitation to come to the Father's house. And then something really strange happens in the parable. It ends. You notice that? What happens? Does he go in? Does he stay out? What does the older son decide to do? See, the reason that the ending is curiously missing is because Jesus is putting the ending to you. See, the story doesn't end with what the older son decides to do. The story ends with what you decide to do. That before you is the grace of a great God. That you are lost, that you are dead. The invitation is to come into the Father's house. And the question is, will you do it? I mean, the question that is before you is, if your life was nothing else other than God's, would that be enough? Let's pray.